Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 9th Annual Neurological Fiesta. I know that many of you have paid big money to be here. And for those of you who remain on the waiting list for brain transplants, have no fear. You may not get your upgraded brain today, but our resident surgeon, David Heatley, is providing a special service for you. If you've grown tired of your brain remaining configured in the traditional position and find it difficult to think honestly about current politics or Keanu Reeves's inarticulate nature, why, Dr. Heatley will be happy to saw open your skull and cause your brain to hang upside down. I assure you that this is a very pleasant feeling, akin to the wondrous gushing gust that a nudist feels up his ass crack when he runs like a lunatic in the streets. Broach the propositions honestly. After all, we only live once.
Okay, so I am here with David Heatley, who is the man behind the book, My Brain is Hanging Upside Down. David, how are you doing?
Excellent. Thank you.
First off, the title brings to mind a few things. My Brain is Hanging Upside Down. On one hand, you have these surreal dream comics that appear and that have been reprinted here. And on the other hand, you're trying to remember details of a previous life. So perhaps we can start by asking a general question about whether these comics are essentially cerebral offerings from you, that it's your way of cerebrally reacting and essentially coming to terms with the personal through your art, or maybe you could describe this a little bit.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, the title does come from a Ramones song, and I like it because it's kind of dumb, clunky American poetry, which is what I think we do best, and it had the right sort of tone to it. But as far as the book being cerebral, you know, I do sort of think it is. I mean, it's a lot of panels are me thinking. You know, there's like lots of thought bubbles, and it's me in my own head, and the pitfalls of that, and also, yeah, just how memory works and how associations are created. And I think the dream comics are a way of getting at maybe a deeper layer than that. And obviously they are carefully considered and structured, and so it's not, I don't think it's just an intellectual exercise. I mean, a lot of it's very heartfelt, emotional terrain for me, but I think it's an accurate characterization that it is a lot about the mental chatter that you collect after 30 years of being on the planet. I mean, yeah. There's an awful lot to deconstruct that you're handed down from everyone you interact with, so.
Yeah. I'm not sure if you've heard this particular story, but Francois Truffaut said this a couple of times in a few interviews, where he looked at a particular photo that was at his desk, and he saw a number of his classmates that he went to school in this particular photo. And he spent the entire day, he wasn't able to name really all of them, and he was only able to name a few of them. And yet, as he spent the entire day staring at this photo, eventually, just by staring at it visually, he was able to recall almost every single name in that particular photo. And yeah. I'm wondering if particularly the history comics were a similar process for you, where it was a matter of essentially sitting down and either staring at either a yearbook or another visual element. I mean, how did your memory work here to recall all these names and all these identities and the like? I mean, in some cases, I know in the family history, you even have some annotations there where you say, well, I can't remember the name of this particular ancestor and the like.
Right.
So what of this?
You know, I think I actually just have a very insane sort of memory. I remember everything. I have kind of a mental file on everyone I've ever met, and I can kind of call details up whenever I see them. And it's just the way my brain functions, you know, categorizes and organizes all this data on people. And so it was all that information was pretty readily at hand. I didn't actually need to go searching for it too much. I needed to just sit down, take the notes, and it all kind of spilled out. And, you know, my father's like that too. He can just recall every, you know, just very specific details on certain days and certain years, and he has a similar kind of brain. So I don't know if it's just, a function of my genes or what. Or if I was traumatized into thinking this way, but I don't know.
Simultaneously, you cannot remember everything. Your memory is going to fill in holes with other images that aren't actually true and the like. And I know that you allude to doing Google research and emailing and making phone calls and the like to actually go ahead and pattern these things out and actually get a more complete portrait of individuals who you have been with or who have known and the like. So I'm not entirely certain I 100% buy that answer.
Well, in some ways what it is too is I've kept a journal for, you know, since I was a teenager. And so that's kind of a way of training your brain to remember and rehearsing these things. And, you know, so there is a backlog of material to refer to. But I didn't crack the journals that much in making the notes. It really does. All I need to do is like write the heading sixth grade, and then, you know, pages and pages really spill out of me. There's not a lot. In terms of getting facts right or fact checking myself or doing certain details, like, there is a little bit of research, but it's not. The bulk of it really kind of comes readily, you know.
Well, yeah. I also want to ask you about this because your stories are often quite personal and very unflinching at times. I mean, some of your asterisks. Footnotes include apologies to your brother Raphael for doing something in front of four nuns. You have also the case of Nat in Black History. You have a note there that, well, this is not his real name. Yeah. You also point out that some people have not actually spoken to you because of things you've depicted in your comics. So I'm wondering, I mean, do you ask others for personal permission to include them in your comics? To what degree do you care about hurting other people's feelings when you're actually going ahead and spilling your guts like this and spilling other people's guts by association?
Yeah, that's a good question. Certain cartoonists say they have like a 10-year rule, and I think that applies to everything in my book. It's been 10 years since pretty much everything transpired in there in terms of ex-girlfriends or, you know, even most of the friends in there. A lot of those friendships have kind of expired, so I kind of feel like that's fair game. I also don't use any last names. And ultimately, this is a book about me. It's about me and, you know, the character of me as a container for experience. And other people, they're characters in my book, and they're the way I remember them, and they're as truthful as I can be. But it really is about a series of kind of impressions on this one mind. And I honestly, I've been lucky. I haven't had a lot of reaction from people from my past, you know, finding me out or accusing me of anything. It hasn't really happened. It may happen now that this is being published widely, but
It's not the entire truth, because obviously Nat has a different first name, and so this makes me say, well, there are certain things that he's withholding from us. I mean, what is really the definition of the complete truth here? Or, you know, where do you stop as a cartoonist or as a narrative teller?
Yeah, that's good. In terms of Nat, it was wanting to protect someone's professional career and their identity, and I just felt like it would be too readily obvious if I used his first name, and trying to be considerate. There's those sort of considerations, but all I can say is I'm only interested in the truth. That's kind of the bottom line for me. And I don't make things up. You know what I mean? I don't make up the dreams. Yeah, well, right. My unconscious mind makes those up. But I'm not interested in kind of bending the truth for my own purposes. I'm really interested in kind of chasing it and describing it as best I can, you know? But I know that sounds like a very old-fashioned kind of thing to say, but it really is true for me. I mean,
but if you are interested in the complete truth, why the pink bars over penises in Sex History? I mean, what was why? Because I see there are plenty of dicks that are flapping in Black History. So what of this artistic decision, so to speak?
Yeah, that was kind of the last layer of narrative that I added to that strip, which was me not really wanting to put pornography into the world. That's one layer of the narrative. The other is that when I originally published the strip without those bars, I got like a lot of 20-something-year-old guys saying, you know, I loved your strip, it gave me a boner, it turned me on, and I just thought this was not the intention of the strip at all. This was really about, you know, bad sex and longing and you know, grasping for something and not attaining it. It's not about titillation. So I think that it was sort of getting lost on the audience a bit, and I wanted to sort of dial it back and make it a little more female friendly, and you know.
But if there is a certain pornographic narrative, and I think it might be argued that there is in that particular story, even pink bars or no pink bars, people are going to probably be turned on. So I'm saying, why flinch from the truth like this? I mean, people are going to get turned on, I suspect, regardless of whether there are those particular pink bars or not.
Yeah, they might be.
It's a risk, I suppose, of making any particular true art.
Yeah, they might be, and ultimately, I mean, it's sort of censorship with a wink, because I did make them fluorescent pink. I didn't make them black bars, just blacking it out. I'm kind of drawing attention to them. So I think it's, you know, it's not an easy, it's a complex solution. I found an artistic solution to the problem that I was having, and it, like any good artistic solution, it has complexity to it. It's not a simple.
Yeah, did you add those pink bars for this, the Pantheon edition?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Was there any kind of pressure from Pantheon to add those pink bars?
Not at all. They were ready to publish it exactly as is, and some of the people in the company didn't even know it was happening until I had kind of slipped them in there, and they said, whoa, okay, I guess that's fine, you know.
Okay.
It was really very much my decision, yeah.
I wanted to also talk with you about your family history strip. I mean, it's probably the closest thing in this collection to a hip-hop montage. You have, of course, the many births with the common images, a mother, one of your ancestors, giving labor with the and
uh-huh.
You have a marriage with the I do, the swath baby who is being held up by the white hands and the like. I wanted to ask why repetitive images or a hip-hop montage seemed the best way to approach your own particular past.
It's funny, I never would have... That phrase, hip-hop montage, is very... it's strange to me, but it also rings true, so yeah, thanks for that. You know, the repetitive thing is about, you know, once I had my own babies, it was a realization that every single person that's ever been born in my family history was this baby at one point, and every mother of that baby grunted in the hospital and pushed it out. So it's, you know, it's sort of honoring all these faceless women who've kind of been lost. And it's also, I think that strip is about, you know, if you take any one of those babies, you could make a book this long about them. And so I'm just one of the babies in that book, and then here's my entire story. And I do it with my daughter at the end, you know, instead of doing one panel for her life, I wind up doing four pages, focusing in on that day. So you could do that for any of those babies, too. You could focus in on what was happening that day when they were born. And
how did you settle on the four N's for the I'm really curious. I mean, did you try out three? Did you try out five?
Yeah.
Or what? Did that just look right? Or four N's really kind of cut that particular verisimilitude?
Yeah. It's, you know, it's like poetry. It felt right, you know. That's a great question. Four N's. I didn't even know they were.
Because it's four N's almost, I mean, we could dig it out right here. I mean, it's four N's almost every single time. I was curious, but.
I actually did. I did remember playing with the number of N's, so it's very astute.
I also wanted to ask you about this all red palette that you use often for extreme emotions, such as, for example, the Martin Luther King and John F. Kennedy assassinations, your own sense of rage that's depicted in Hardline.
Yeah.
It reminded me very much of David Rees, and I'm wondering, how did you come about this particular all red palette? And also, while we're on the subject of palettes, you often have black text against a yellow background to single out a particular panel, and I'm curious why you chose red and yellow in these respective incidents.
Yeah. Well, I mean, comics is sort of a crude medium, so, you know, red for anger, you know. But there's something really primal and powerful about doing something that dumb and basic, and I would say it wasn't, none of this was the coloring, none of that is really a conscious decision. It's not a conscious structuring. I mean, that's probably the easiest part of my job and the most intuitive. When I've penciled and inked and it's in the computer and I'm just coloring, I'm really kind of floating free, and the colors suggest themselves, and they just kind of keep being moved around until they feel right. And the thing about, you know, the yellow text box, it probably felt right on the first page I did it, and then that became the rule. It's like, well, then every single yellow box has to be that way. And so, you know, you arrive at these rules for yourself in a more intuitive sense, and then they become a little more rigid as you go. And the same thing with the red, you know, memories. If it was a specific one and it felt like related in terms of content, you know, it got colored the same way.
I'm wondering if you tinkered around with shades of red or shades of yellow to get that specific hue, or whether you even tried other colors altogether to get that, or whether, you know, this was, as you say, at least with the yellow, a sort of first intuitive decision.
Yeah, I definitely do a lot of, you know, tinkering around with color. The other thing is, I've been, you know, making comics for about 10 years, and once you see things in print, you kind of see which colors work and which don't, and you wind up collecting something of a you know, a usable set of colors, and so you'll open up an old file and say, you know, I need that red here, and that one becomes your red. And,
yeah.
And I've also done things like scanned other people's books and sort of seen what palette, like the family history is actually a palette used by a Japanese cartoonist from the 30s, and I just thought this feels right for whatever reason. I'm going to scan his in and approximate it. So.
Well, on the subject of colors, I should point out that sex history is done with a rather muted color scheme, with the exception of the picture of your wife on the side, which has this very bright red color for the background. And yeah. I'm wondering why you wanted to mute the colors for that. Did you feel that, again, just as the pink bars were a way of taking the edge off of something that was perhaps, that might be misconstrued as vibrant pornography of some sort, that this was kind of the MO here? Or?
That's interesting. You know, in some ways, the, you know, I don't think of these things. So you're helping me to put words to something that's a very intuitive process, but in some way I could say that the rest of the strip is muted because that's not where the real heart lies. You know, the passion, the red behind my wife, that's where the passion of my sex life really is. And so the rest of this is just sort of a, you know, this, it could be almost in gray. I mean, it's that kind of like sad, lonely, desperate, clinging, longing, grasping kind of period that I went through, and yeah, I guess that's as good an answer as I can give you.
Okay, well then let's talk actually about the paneling. The 48 panel setup that you use, the 6x8 for both sex history, yeah, black history, and then also on top of that, you have this total disregard for straight lines in the actual panels themselves. Although, by the time you get to kin or family history, suddenly, oh, everything's completely straight. The guy's using a ruler. I'm wondering why, when you started to care about making things clean like that, as opposed to this loosey-goosey, squiggly format of things kind of veering off, but kind of more or less being arranged. Yeah. And then why also that 48-panel structure to play with? Well, I mean, it's also quite imposing, but I mean, you needed a big book, obviously, to actually capture that, but
yeah.
I have to ask how you arrived at that mathematical formula.
You know, in some ways it was an extreme reaction. There's a number of my peers about 5 years ago or 4 years ago were doing these books with like four panels on a page and one panel on a page and calling that a graphic novel, and I felt a certain kind of outrage, like that is not a full novel, I'm sorry, you took one strip and then, you know, extended it over 150 pages, and I'm not buying it, you know.
You want to get your money's worth then.
This was my extreme reaction, that like I'll put 48 panels per page, and you know, so that's one answer. The other thing is, I was thinking, I don't really want to dwell on my life story my whole career. I mean, I really want to do fiction, and I want to explore other territory. And there's certain cartoonists who've like made their whole career about documenting their sex life and their ex-girlfriends. And so my attitude was sort of like, well, I could just get this all done in 15 pages and be done with it.
But clearly it didn't happen because black history goes on forever. Right? I mean, you know, I mean, I was actually like, you know, I was surprised when it ended, quite frankly, you know.
Yeah, well, right. The sex history does end after 15 pages, and I thought black history would be about the same, and I found as I was working on it, it grew and grew and grew and grew. I had more and more to say on the subject, and, you know, the writing process of this book is not something I feel like I had any control over. I really felt like I was kind of pulled out to sea and, you know, thrown around in the tide and then dumped back out when the thing was done. So
yeah.
The pieces really dictated how long they needed to be.
Okay, but I mean, back to this notion of the small square. I mean, you're saying here that you didn't really want to delve into your personal life throughout the course of your career. Did you feel that the small squares offered a protective buffer to that effect? That if your particular life story was confined in these small boxes, that, well, you could then sort of say, well, hey, I didn't blow it up, you know, to the whole full page or even half a page.
No,
I mean, here
it
is in these little mini, it's almost like a kind of a mini comic epic to some degree.
Yeah, no, I'm inspired by mini comic artists who can kind of like, I'm also inspired by Chris Ware's diary comics, which are microscopic, and yeah, they're like looking into little Joseph Cornell boxes or something, one after the other. I like how intimate they feel. The other thing is, it was a formal decision. Like, I knew that I wanted to draw these strips at 100% and not draw them larger and reduce them. I knew I wanted them to have a real diaristic, you know, first take kind of quality. And I have a certain standard of density in the artwork that I make that it just has to have a certain, you know, if you look at anything I've ever done, it has this kind of crammed denseness to it. So part of it was just that, like thinking, okay, well, what's going to really fill this page to my liking? And you know, it felt right. Any less panels than that would have felt a little bit too airy or something.
And yeah, when dwelling on your mom and dad, I mean, there is certainly a Chris Ware influence in the number of jobs that they've had, and also following the continuing aging process through the course of one's jobs or even one's cars. But actually, there's another influence I noticed, and it reminded me very much of Dave Berg's Lighter Side comics, because not only is there no set number of panels for each particular story, but there isn't always a punchline at the end of each comic like Dave Berg, in the sense that, we're kind of getting a conclusion, and there's also a thematic arc to all this as well. And I wanted to ask you about how you arrived at that. Was Dave Berg an influence on this, or why did you feel in dealing with your parents that you wanted to avoid the 48 panel layout, or was it just a matter of like, Jesus Christ, if I stare at the 6x8 pattern, I'm going to go insane?
Yeah, some of it is for the sake of your own, you know, keeping it interesting for your sonic variety. I did my dad's portrait first, and it goes back further than that for me. It goes back to, you know, my very first time making art. I was drawn to making portraits, you know, when I was a painter, and then I was a filmmaker in undergrad school and art school, and I was trying to make portrait films of friends and thinking about, you know, the quadrant. I would project four quadrants on the screen and divide it and, you know, do these sort of cubist portraits of friends. And when I started doing comics more seriously, it was like, how could I do kind of a cubist portrait in comics? How can you do something that's sort of getting at all these different sides of a person simultaneously? And this was like a kind of a formal device I picked up from Dan Clowes and Chris Ware. And I just thought, well, they've done this way of organizing the page where these little strips add up to a larger story. But what if I took that and focused it on one person and you know, would it add up to a portrait? So that was the idea behind that. I wanted this book to feel really varied. It would just be like hitting you over the head if it was 48 panels a page for 128 pages. I wanted it to be many different styles. Like the dreams are much bigger. They're more painterly. They're brushy. And, you know, the diaries are drawn with a little pen. And then these other comic strips, you know, there's really three of them. There's the case wrap of the book itself, which is sort of my self-portrait. Then there's the two portraits of my parents. You know, they're more referencing that traditional Sunday page or these little, I just, bite-sized bits of information, you know, boiling it all the way down to three panels. And, you know, what can you pack into that? What can you say with that? So,
well, while we're dwelling also on the mom and dad sections, mm-hmm. I should point out that suddenly the lettering becomes a lot cleaner in those particular sections. And this goes back to a question I asked you, which I didn't quite get an answer from, concerning the fact that you went from these really squiggly panel lines to something that was extraordinarily precise. I'm wondering if the situation was this, that, well, maybe your parents are going to be reading these particular comics, and as such, you want to have your penmanship better? But why the sort of, I guess, the more professional shift here than the actual comic?
Well, the honest answer is, you know, when I look at this book, I feel like five different people drew it, and it was about, a lot of the work on this book was organizing it and making it coherent and making it feel like it was from one person, because over the last 10 years, I've really developed my style and grown into the way I want to do things. And so, yeah, when I was doing my dad's portrait, I was very enthralled with Chris Ware's way of doing everything, where everything is ruled out, even the background details are done with a ruler, and the lettering was done with a ruler, and, you know, and instead of like trying to fight that or make it all consistent in some way, I went with it and said, you know, that was the way I drew it then, and I'm going to trust that it had something to do with the content. So, you know, there's a certain rigidity to my dad's strip, my mom's strip, I knew I wanted it to be looser. So there's no ruler on the panel. There's no ruler on the lettering. It's much more about who my mom is versus who my dad is. So there's a certain amount of trust that you say, you know, there's a reason I did this a certain way, and I'm not going to second guess it. I wasn't really in control of what was motivating these choices at the time.
You know? I'm wondering, though, I mean, if you have the ruler there, suddenly things become too precise. Therefore, you can't necessarily exonerate yourself because it looks too slick, and therefore there's the authenticity factor, perhaps. I don't know if that might be something here.
Well, yeah, to some extent. I mean, yeah, some of it is just experimentation, though, and seeing what kind of effects create what, you know, and a ruler's a very specific tool, and it conjures a certain feeling when you see perfectly ruled out lines. Mm-hmm.
You had mentioned the notion of being traumatized earlier in this conversation, and I also dug up a Granta interview in which you said that you were traumatized into preferring memoir. I mean, what do you mean by that? Are you trying to tell me that you're Eli Wetzel? I mean, what the hell's going on here?
I really like your abrasive tone. It's fun. What I meant by that was I have a dad who has really lived in a world of fantasy all growing up. I mean, if it wasn't Star Wars, then it was Star Trek, and then it was Lord of the Rings, and it was like it's been his whole life. Now it's Stargate, you know, and so I think having that shoved down your throat as a kid and be, you know, still be the main way he tries to relate to me and my brothers, you know, there's something traumatizing about that. Like, you wind up craving reality with kind of a vengeance, you know, and that's one way I put it was like I've wanted encyclopedias of truth to counteract the sea of fantasy I was raised in. You know, there's that kind of reactionary streak to what I'm doing.
Got it. So really, it was essentially the inundation of imagination that had you drifting more towards things that came from your brain. Then that's what I'm getting at.
Well, it's not, imagination's good. It's not that. It's sort of like imagination at the expense of reality, you know? And people just crave honest, real interaction with other human beings, you know? Yeah.
I also wanted to ask you about your annotations. You frequently have a specific detail highlighted by an arrow that begins on one end with an arrowhead, of course, and the other has a circle. And this was intriguing to me because it's almost as if you were somewhat apologetic for not getting a particular detail right, like, say, for example, the fact that you had shaved your hair. And I'm not even certain it's really fair to castigate yourself because the panel is so small. But what I wanted to ask you how this came about. Was this a way of essentially being almost apologetic for not getting something absolutely precise or not having the full amount of space to really get that particular detail presented to the reader?
The arrow thing, I think, comes from Dick Tracy originally, and then it was picked up by Aline Kaminsky-Crum in her comics, and she does it to sort of comment on her appearance. But, you know, all these tools, it's just like yet another container or layer of information, and so you can use it like a footnote, or this is an extraneous bit, but it'll help the readability. You can use it, you know, against expectation, so there's sometimes you're just having fun with the arrow. But yeah, it's just a way of adding more information and clarifying if, like, suddenly the main character of the strip has a shaved head, you might want to know, oh, that's still me that I'm talking about there. That's that guy over there is still me.
But then again, there's this room for ambiguity. All of a sudden, if you have a shaved head, then you have to sort of think about this a little bit more rather than highlight this out. I mean, I'm wondering if this represents a certain anxiety of ambiguity on your part.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe there's a slight perfectionist streak in me wanting to get this all buttoned up and all, you know, told in just the right way. Yeah. That's probably fair to say.
Well, I mean, why not just capitulate to badness as you have done in your dream comics? I mean, there's a number of things in there that really one must look at, and one must parse, one must wonder if it's actually true or not. I mean, you know, this is the nature of dreams. The fact that you have you and your wife as the chief protagonists in these comics is rather alarming at times, because it's almost as if she's part of this interesting surreal experience, and you have to essentially do a double take for these particular comics, and you say to yourself, well, yes, it's a dream, but is it really a dream?
I'm not sure what that question was. Are you asking, are they really dreams?
Well, no, I mean, the question of maybe I should ask you specifically about why you include your wife in these particular dream comics. Do you dream of your wife in there with you? Or, I mean, how much of these are essentially you being a stenographer and taking the dreams that come out of your head and putting them onto paper? I mean, or, and obviously there has to be some embellishment because one cannot wake up and have the precise dream that, no, you know, there's always, again, it goes back to the memory question we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, no, they do sort of get transformed into fiction in the process of creating them. But no, I do wake up, I write them down in my journal, and I write them without a sense of style. It's just about documenting what happened, and then I'll read that usually a full year later and say, that's the one that needs to be in there. And yeah, my wife's in a bunch of them. I don't add her to dreams that she wasn't in. You know, if she was in there, there's a reason. I don't really mess with the logic that was at play when I created it while asleep. I mean, that's the thing I'm trying to actually crystallize and capture as authentically as I can.
How much do you have to shift them into the needs of narrative? Because you need to have a beginning, middle, and an end to some degree, and dreams aren't always like that. You'll start with some particular imagination or image, and then it will go into something else, and it won't make any particular sense until you're sitting there trying to think about it the next morning. You know?
Well, I think, honestly, the first layer of editing your dream is when you first wake up, because your brain, just in remembering it, orders it and makes it into... I mean, we're such narrative-making machines, so... That's what happens. Before I even write it down, it's become a coherent little story for myself. But I also don't think that takes away from what was going on in my brain during the night. It's just my way of like communicating to myself. And as some therapists say, you know, in describing a dream to a therapist, if you add details on the spot that weren't in the dream, it almost doesn't matter because it's sort of, you've accessed that place and they're coming from the same place. And that's what you're sort of trying to channel. And so, yeah, there's definitely little detailed background details added. There's like casting that goes on. Oh, who should this person be? You know, but I try and have that attitude. Like I'm just the dutiful client to the therapist, like just reporting and trying to get at the truth of this dream as much as possible. You know,
you depict yourself in therapy in many of these particular comics. I must ask what role therapy has had upon your particular comics. Has therapy encouraged you to do more of these dream comics or to at least confront the truth more effectively? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely a big proponent of therapy. I would argue that this book is not about doing therapy, though. In fact, I try and choose dreams that I don't really analyze. I try and keep them a little bit ambiguous for myself, and that keeps them alive. And it's not... I feel like this book is my best way of talking about the world. It's not so much about just getting my personal demons out of the way. I don't think that makes for very good art. If people couldn't relate to it beyond, isn't this an interesting guy, then I think I failed. But I'm trying to use my experience as like a microcosm to talk about, you know, America or the world or whatever you want to, however grandiose you want to get with it. But that's what I'm trying to do. I have larger intentions than...
I also want to ask you as well about the notion of cliche in personal comics. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've read a lot of personal comics, and what I often see is the sort of angst or the shyness or the diffidence, or the usual kinds of routines that one sees. So generally some male cartoonist who's probably in his 20s trying to figure out, can't get the girl, that kind of thing. What you talked about earlier about cartoonists who make a career out of actually drawing and writing about their sex lives. But this, I think, actually tries to avoid that cliche in a large way because you depict yourself sobbing from time to time, which is, I think, very different from this particular cliche. And yet, when we're talking about cliche, when we're talking about the transposition of your personal life into a medium, well, there runs the risk of, well, if I'm actually being true, how am I true without actually brushing up against this particular cliche? Is this something you dwell upon in arranging all the data for these particular comics?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I'm sure it's in the soup somewhere of what's going on, what goes into creating these things of like wanting to move away from a certain model or towards another. But I would hope on the whole not. I'd hope that I have, you know, I have something of an ideal reader in mind when I make these, and it's sort of like trying to get it right and talking directly to that person.
Who is that ideal reader?
Often it's a female reader, actually. Like, people are surprised to hear this, but I feel like the sex history was mostly written for, like, a female reader. Because I'd be utterly fascinated to hear a similar account to of a woman cartoonist. Like, you know, what was it like on your side of the fence? Because,
yeah.
You know, a lot of times I didn't have a clue. And so there's, yeah, it's trying to peel back the layer and say, this is what, if in case you were wondering, this is what was going on, you know.
I'm wondering if you think about this notion of, like, well, male cartoonists can get away about writing unflinchingly about their sex lives or unflinchingly about many details, whereas if a woman does that, they are sometimes accused of exploiting or being performance artist-like or whatnot, so that there is this kind of double standard, I think. This is interesting in light of the fact, in light of your answer about what you view your ideal reader to be.
Well, I'd say... you know, some of the biggest influences on me were women cartoonists. There's Aileen Kaminsky Crum, there's Carol Tyler, Debbie Dreschler, and Julie Doucet might be the biggest one. And she certainly, she's as unflinching as it gets. I mean, when I read her dream comics, you know, in the 90s, it was like, you know, if she can do these dreams about, like, chopping off her friend's penis and eating it and menstruating and this, all, it was like, and you read it and it's sort of not, it's not horrifying, it's almost a little bit cute, you know. She gets away with it. I thought, wow, there's some real power in this, and I want to know what it is that she knows. I want to learn how to do this, you know.
Well, what's the fermentation process like for, say, an extraordinary incident, like, say, you know, a girl fucking a dog? I mean, this is something that is very difficult to translate into an accessible comic, or a comic that people can read and not have the notion of, like, oh, well, this was intended to shock, or this is intended to essentially stand out in some way. I mean, what steps do you take to arrange that, say, the dog fucking narrative?
Jesus. I would just say, on the whole, things take about a year for me to fully digest them before they make it onto the page. I can't, with few exceptions, I can't, like, readily, although I'm getting better at it, you almost need that much distance from an event to fully process it for yourself. So any of the dreams I drew, at least a full year had passed, and I was looking at them with fresh eyes, and, you know, the original charge, emotional charge of the dream had long since faded, and it was about, okay, how can I be the artist now and, you know, use my craft to kind of, like, approximate what that might have felt like.
But if the emotion is dissipated, how do you recapture it?
Well, that's what's sort of interesting about it. It becomes its own, it becomes a new project, you know. It, like I said, it becomes about making a little piece of fiction. And yeah, you've got that original experience to hold up as that would be the ideal, but you also know that you're almost creating something in parallel to it. Like, it becomes an entirely new experience, and you have to sort of embrace that. You can't think of it as, like, oh, I failed to fully capture exactly what that felt like. It has to be, well, it's this now. You know,
I'm also curious, to what degree do you use a computer in relation to your work? I mean, I saw some colors that appeared enhanced by a computer, and also some images that were inserted in that were clearly not drawn or not even washboarded on or whatnot. So I must ask what the level of actual hand to digital use is for you.
Yeah, well, I do color almost all my strips in the computer. I certainly prepare everything for print in the computer. I do all my image research on Google, you know. But every single line and every letter is hand-drawn. That's just kind of something I learned from, you know, my predecessors, and it's the way I want to do things too. There's something about having this object that someone, you know, painstakingly created every little line on that makes it kind of nuts, honestly, kind of insane in a good way. So Yeah, the writing process, there's no computer involved. It's all about making notes on paper. All the drawing process, there's no computer. It's really about cleaning up mistakes here and there. Sometimes I'll kern my own lettering a little bit or add some space that way. And definitely all the coloring gets done if I haven't painted it. But even when I paint it, there's an awful lot of retouching and assembly in the computer. But that Black History strip, I drew it in this cafe. The originals were this big. I sat in this very cafe and drew for 3 months.
Well, speaking of Black History, I was very curious about how the interludes came into the narrative of remembering specific figures. I mean, these interludes deal with some very hard realities about race in this country. I mean, you depict your father, for example. He says, "Nigger's not a racist word for me. It's just a good word to use when I'm angry." And that was a very extraordinary truth for you to reveal about your own particular father.
Yeah.
How did this come to be? Did you feel that you needed to have this overarching thematic confrontation so that it was not just about you, that it was about this larger situation about race in this country?
That's a good question. Honestly, it felt as important, more important in some ways, as sex to include in the book. I mean, when I was drawing up the list of things to include in this book, race was right up there. And I think it's because, as a writer, you kind of realize where your strengths are and what about your experience is worth telling and feels kind of unique. And my experience of race in this country feels unique. Like, the town I grew up in feels unique. It wasn't a typical suburban white town that I grew up in. And I have a lot to say on the subject, in terms of how truthful it is, that's just the standard I set for myself with everything I do. So the things that I felt tempted to look away from, those are the ones to focus even more on. That kind of became the rule for the strip. And that particular paradox or that contradiction that my dad has always, and by the way, he's completely cooled off from any of that sort of behavior. This was at the height of his own kind of, whatever you want to call it, insanity.
Meltdown.
Yeah, so, but yeah, that definitely shaped me.
You even depict yourself getting angry and using racist language and the like as you're trying to come to terms with these kids who were aggravating you in your particular apartment. And so that's why I bring this up, that you can say all you want. You can defend this idea that, someone is different now, but the fact that someone has said that or someone has offered that indicates something I think that is really true. I mean, it's something really ugly. I don't think it's something that can be completely discounted.
I don't use that word at all lightly. I mean, I see it as like a deeply offensive word, and I was very careful about the places it got used in the narrative and for what reasons. I mean, I really, as a white person, I have no business using that word, And that goes along with what I was saying about just the amount of chatter in your head and the amount of baggage you're handed down. I mean, I don't really know what kind of baggage my dad was handed down from his family, and he grew up, near Buffalo on a farm, and what kind of people he was around using that word when he was a kid. So, maybe he's come miles beyond that, and I hope I've gone miles beyond my own father in terms of my sensitivity and my understanding. But this is the stuff that you're. This is like, if you don't process it, you're just acting out unconsciously all these things that you were given throughout your life.
But if you don't present it in some way and you fear the idea of political correctness, however ugly something is, then you can't actually deal with truth. And again, it goes back to this pink bars dilemma that we had initiated this conversation with.
Well, yeah, I think I don't think I am being PC. I mean, I'm saying some really uncomfortable things. I'm saying things that I think white people are incredibly cagey when it comes to talking about race. They feel like they have no business. And it's either they're either sort of unconscious about their own racism and they're too cavalier about saying they understand the problem or belittling the problem, or they're so afraid of offending that it's like, you know, everything gets wrapped in layers and layers of PC language. So yeah, it is an attempt to cut through some of that and just say, let's just look at this, you know.
You mentioned the idea that what you are presenting in these comics is unique, and yet, inarguably, there are overlapping elements that represent the common experience. I'm wondering if you perhaps are too concerned with being unique as opposed to simply depicting something that may, in fact, have some shared common experience with the reader or with this ideal reader who you were mentioning earlier.
Too concerned with being unique. It's interesting. Yeah, certainly, like, my ego would like to think that I'm the most unique, wonderful person on the planet. I try not to listen to that voice, so maybe that gets in there. But like I said before, I think this is about talking about a larger world than my world. And so it's finding that balance between, you know, this will stick out enough as feeling fresh and interesting to a reader, but it'll be a common enough experience for them to resonate with it. So I think I've done a good job of striking that balance. I think people can read this book. I mean, people pick it up and they can't stop reading it. It's very, very engaging, and they find themselves reading it automatically. So I think it succeeds on that level. And but I do think it's a very specific person that's, you know, that's being shown here. I feel like that about everyone. I feel like, you know, anyone could tell their story and make it interesting, because no one has quite the same experience as any other person. So.
Well, David, thanks very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks for talking.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, this is the job.